Imagine hiring a $1,000 an hour consultant, locking them in a completely empty room and making them fill out a formal multi-page requisition form every single time they just want to look at a simple piece of paper on your desk.
Right, which sounds completely
It
absurd.
does. But according to this advanced 2026 course chapter by Anthropic, that is literally what 9 out of 10 developers are doing to their AI models right now.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal waste of resources. We see it constantly, when developers start building architecture for artificial intelligence.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are looking at a massive shift in how we build AI systems, specifically focusing on the Model Context Protocol, or MCP. And
Exactly.
our mission today is to basically save you from that 90% failure rate. We're going to look at three foundational building blocks. Those are tools, resources, and prompts.
But I mean, choosing the wrong one doesn't just make your code look messy.
Right.
It directly impacts the latency of your application, and it will just completely balloon your API bills.
So for anyone who hasn't encountered it yet, MCP is essentially the connective tissue between language models, the client applications you use, and, well, external servers.
Yeah, it's the standardized protocol that solves the problem of securely giving models access to your company's data and systems.
But the course material makes it very clear that getting that basic triad, the tools, resources, and prompts, getting that correct is fundamentally misunderstood by most of the industry.
Oh, absolutely. Almost right out of the gate.
So to understand how to actually get this architecture right, we need to start by, tearing apart that massive mistake almost everyone makes.
The 9 out of 10 mistake.
Exactly. And based on the Anthropic chapter, I'm assuming this usually happens the exact second a developer is asked to connect a model to a company's internal knowledge base.
Yeah, that is the classic trap right there. A developer is tasked with letting the AI read internal documentation. And invariably, their very first instinct is to build an MCP tool called something like Search Docs.
Right, search docs.
They set it up so the tool takes a query string, runs a search, and then returns matching documents to the model.
Which, I mean, sounds completely logical. If you build a web app, you build a search
Yes,
bar.
it's intuitive.
But the text treats this like a cardinal sin of AI architecture.
Because a knowledge base is read-only data. It's information the model should just be able to look at.
It doesn't need to ask for it.
Right. Forcing the model to actually execute a search command creates a devastating chain reaction for your system's overall performance.
So if I'm doing that, I'm basically pausing the whole conversation so the model can go run a query, wait for a network response, and then resume generating text.
Exactly. You're forcing an entirely unnecessary inference turn. Let's break down what actually happens under the hood.
Walk me through it.
So the model starts generating a response, realizes it needs a document, stops generating, formats a tool call, and sends it over the network.
Okay.
The server processes it, sends the document back, and only then does the model start generating again. Every single one of those round trips burns your token budget, it costs you money, and it adds seconds of latency for the user who's just sitting there staring at a loading spinner.
And going back to that expensive consultant in the empty room, if I already know the consultant is working on the Q3 marketing report, I should just put the Q2 report on their desk before they even arrive. I
Exactly.
shouldn't make them ask for it.
Right. By forcing the model to initiate a search tool every single time, you completely strip away the host application's ability to proactively preload context.
Which seems like a huge missed opportunity.
It is. You lose all editorial control. The app already knows what screen the user is looking at, right? It should just feed that relevant data directly into the context window.
Okay, this brings us to a really crucial distinction then. If a developer isn't supposed to use a tool to let the model read documents, what actually belongs in that category? What is a tool?
Well, the precise definition in the source material is that tools are operations initiated by the model that may have side effects.
Side effect.
Right. They return a result, sure. But the key word really is side effects. Tools are the model's hands.
I like that analogy, the hands.
Yeah, they are the single primitive in the MCP ecosystem where mutation, meaning actually changing a state outside the conversation, is expected and permitted.
So, creating a Jira ticket, executing a shell command on a server, sending a Slack message, deleting a file,
Yeah.
those are the hands interacting with the world.
And the way the model knows how to use those hands is through something called an input schema.
Right, I saw that mentioned heavily in the text.
For anyone who hasn't worked heavily with data structures lately, a JSON schema is just a standardized format that outlines exactly what data a system expects to receive.
Got it.
The host passes this schema to the model so it knows the specific arguments required to run the tool.
I have to push back on this section of the text a little bit, though.
Okay, go for it.
Because it emphasizes getting incredibly granular with these schemas. But, I mean, we're dealing with trillion-parameter, highly advanced models now. If I just name a tool send Slack message and give it a super vague description, a modern model is going to figure out what I mean, isn't it?
You'd think so, but no. The Anthropic course actually uses that exact send Slack message example to illustrate why a vague schema will crash your integration.
Really? Just completely crash it?
Yeah. The description field inside a JSON schema isn't just API metadata for a human developer to read. It is fundamentally a prompt for the model.
Oh, I think I see where this is going. Because it's an LLM, it's operating on predictive text generation.
Exactly. It's a statistical engine at its core. It reads that description to decide when and how to call the tool.
Okay.
If your description just says, you know, send a message, the model has no solid signal about when to trigger it. But the real danger is in the arguments.
The parameters it passes.
Right. Let's say you just have a generic string field called channel. The model's training data is full of internet scraping, where Slack channels are called hashtag general or hashtag marketing.
Oh, man. So its statistical weights will pull it toward those display names.
Exactly. But the actual Slack API requires a specific alphanumeric channel ID, something like C01234567.
So the model hallucinates the display name, sends it to the API, and the whole tool call just fails.
Fails completely, which is why the course lays out three strict principles for tool schemas.
Lay them on me.
First, write the description as behavioral instructions, not just a label. Tell it exactly when to use it.
Makes sense.
Second, be ruthless about marking fields as required versus optional. Don't let the model guess if a parameter is needed. And third, use enum constraints wherever possible.
An enum constraint. That's essentially defining a strict drop-down menu of choices, right?
Yeah, you give it an array of specific allowed values. If a field only accepts three specific project statuses, you define those three exact strings in the schema.
And it won't stray from that.
Exactly. When the model sees the allowed set, the mathematical probability of it hallucinating a format drops to near zero.
That's fascinating. The text also mentions a major detail about control flow here that caught my eye.
Oh, about who initiates.
Yeah, that the host application can't actually force the model to use a tool.
That's a critical point. The control flow for tools is entirely autonomous.
Totally up to the model.
The host application can show the model the menu of available hands, but the model decides independently when to call a tool, if it calls one at all, and what arguments it passes.
So we've solved how the model takes action, but let's go back to that empty room. We know we shouldn't use a tool to search the knowledge base.
Right.
So how do we actually get the files onto the desk efficiently?
That is the domain of the second primitive. Resources.
Resources.
Think of resources as the model's library. They are read-only data identified by a URI that either the model or the host application can inject into the context.
Okay. Either the model or the host application, that solves the proactive loading problem we talked about.
Exactly.
Instead of the model stopping the conversation to ask for a file, the application just injects a read-gendemy document into the context before the user even types a single word.
Boom. The model never wasted a turn or burned a single token asking for it. It just has the context.
Incredible.
And you mentioned URIs earlier. Uniform resource identifiers, like web addresses. The protocol uses a specific standard called RFC 6570 for URI templates.
Right, I wanted to ask about that. For the listener, an RFC 6570 template just means what exactly?
Sure.
Because if I have a company GitHub repository with a million files in it, I am absolutely not hard coding a million individual URIs into my server.
Oh, definitely not. You use a pattern matching system.
Okay.
Instead of listing every single file, the server exposes a template string, something like github.ownerrepoblobspath.
So it's like having a master key at a hotel.
Exactly.
You don't need a million individual metal keys jingling on a massive keychain. You just have one digital pattern that can instantly unlock whatever room door you walk up to.
As long as you provide the right room number.
Right.
The host or the model provides the actual values to the specific repository and file path, and the server expands that template to fetch the exact concrete resource.
That's incredibly elegant.
One template represents billions of potential files effortlessly.
Let's apply this to a really massive dynamic system, though. The source material outlines an example of building an integration for an internal documentation platform.
Something like Confluence.
Yeah, exactly like Confluence. Let's say you have 10,000 pages spread across 500 team spaces.
Mm.
The curveball here is that these pages aren't static.
Right. Human editors are updating them in real time.
All the time.
That is basically the ultimate stress test for an AI architecture. First, you utilize those resource templates, likely using a stable page ID in the URI so your integration doesn't break every time someone tweaks a page title.
Okay, that covers finding the page.
But the real threat is stale data.
Right. If an HR editor updates the corporate travel policy, but my AI model already loaded the old version into its context window yesterday,
it's going to confidently hallucinate based on yesterday's rules.
Which is a disaster.
To solve this, the protocol includes a feature for resources called subscriptions. And it leverages a pattern known as pull-on-push.
Pull-on-push. Okay, let's unpack that. I'm assuming that means instead of the server aggressively shoving a massive text update down the pipe to everyone connected, the client is actually doing the work.
Basically, yeah. Let's compare it to traditional polling. Normally, an app asks a server every 5 seconds. Any updates? Any updates? Any updates?
Which just wastes massive amounts of bandwidth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Alternatively, the server could push the entire new 10-page document to the client every time there's a comma changed, which bogs down the network.
Right.
Pull-on-push is the elegant middle ground.
So when the human editor hits save on that document,
the server sends a tiny microscopic notification to the subscribed client.
Just a ping.
Just a ping. It simply says, the resource at this specific URI has changed.
Got it.
The client receives that ping, decides if it actually needs the new data right now, and if so, it pulls the fresh content by requesting a reread of the resource.
It's just a tap on the shoulder like, hey, go grab the new version when you're ready. That prevents the model from working with stale context while keeping the network traffic incredibly light.
So we have the model's hands for actions and the library for read-only data.
But there is a massive blind spot here that we haven't touched on.
Richard.
We've talked about the model initiating actions and the host app injecting data. What about the human being sitting at the keyboard?
Yes.
When the user wants to initiate a specific repeatable task, neither tools nor resources seem to really fit.
Which is why developers must implement the third and easily the most skipped primitive.
Prompts.
Prompts.
The user steering wheel? I'll admit, when I first read the section on prompts, I conflated it with system prompts.
It happens a lot.
I was thinking, why wouldn't I just type out a really good instruction set myself? Or use a text expander snippet on my laptop? Why does the server architecture need a dedicated prompt primitive?
Because it's not about system prompts at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's about discoverability and structured intent across an entire ecosystem.
Structured intent.
Yeah. Prompts are user-initiated, parameterized message templates hosted on the server. To visualize this, think about slash commands in a modern UI, like Slack or Linear.
Oh, like when I'm in Slack and I type Zoom, I don't have to write out, please initiate a Zoom meeting and send the link.
No, the UI just knows what you want to do.
It's just a shortcut.
When an MCP server exposes prompts, the host application surfaces them as a searchable, clickable menu across all connected servers.
That's super convenient.
You no longer have to remember the perfect magic words to coax the AI into doing what you want. The server lists the prompts and the specific arguments they require right there in the UI.
The Anthropic course gives the example of a draft reply prompt.
Yeah, that's a great one. The server exposes draft reply and specifies it needs a ticketed and a tone.
Okay.
The user just clicks the option in the UI and fills in those two blanks. Then the host application sends a request to the server, and the server returns the fully rendered messages. It automatically fetches the customer's history, embeds the specific ticket context into the template, and that robust package becomes the very start of your conversation with the model.
It takes the burden of initiating off the model, and it takes the burden of writing the perfect context completely off the user.
Exactly.
Another example they gave was a weekly status report. You select the prompt, pick your team name, pick the date range, and boom, the template populates.
And you would never use a tool for that.
Right, because a tool leaves it up to the model to decide when to generate a report.
For repeatable, structured tasks, you want the user firmly in the driver's seat.
So the architectural pieces are all on the board now. Tools, resources, prompts.
The triad.
But knowing what they are is only half the battle. When a developer is staring at a blank screen trying to build a new feature, how do they actually choose the right one without second-guessing themselves?
The course provides a rigorous 3-question decision rule to classify any integration requirement.
Okay, let's hear it.
Question 1, who initiates? Question 2, what does it do? And question 3, who controls the access policy.
Let's test this framework. I'm going to run through some rapid-fire examples from the text, and let's see how they map out.
Let's do it.
First one, the user asks the AI to create a JIRA ticket.
That is a tool. It is initiated by the model during the conversation, and it has a definitive side effect, creating a new object in a completely external system.
Nail it. Next scenario, fetching the current on-call engineering schedule. It's read-only, but it changes every single day.
That is a resource.
Even though it changes.
Yep, because it's read-only, there are no side effects. More importantly, the application can preload today's schedule into the context window without the model ever having to ask for it.
Okay, here's the tricky one from the chapter. Get recent pager duty alerts from the last 24 hours.
Yeah. This one is purposefully ambiguous to show why the three questions matter.
Let's walk the framework.
Who initiates, well, could be the model on demand or the app could preload it. What does it do? It's read-only, so no side effects. So far, it could be a tool or a resource.
The sticking point is the phrase, the last 24 hours. That implies a dynamic time range.
Which brings us to question three. Who controls the access policy? Does the model need to dynamically decide what alert data it analyzes? Or does the on-call team's UI make that policy decision?
In most enterprise environments, it's the UI tooling.
Exactly. Therefore, the optimal classification is a resource mapped to a URI, like PagerDuty.alerts recent, utilizing a subscription for live updates.
But let's flip it. When would that exact same data need to be a tool?
It becomes a tool the second the model needs to dynamically change the parameters.
Oh, I see.
If a user says, show me server alerts from last Tuesday between 2 and 4 p.m., but only for the database team, the model has to actively use its hands to shape a custom query.
It has to invent the parameters on the fly.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, let me throw one final trap at you from the text. A developer builds a tool called GetCurrentUserProfile. It takes zero arguments, and it runs at the start of almost every single conversation to give the AI the user's name and corporate role. Tool, resource, or prompt.
That is a fatal architectural flaw.
It really is, isn't it?
A zero-argument tool that returns static session data is just a resource wearing an incredibly expensive disguise.
It's the consultant in the empty room filling out a requisition form just to ask for their own name tag.
Think about the mechanics we discussed earlier. Every time the model calls that zero argument tool, it stops generating, formulates a network request, waits for a response, and then resumes.
Such a waste.
It spends an entire LLM inference turn just to fetch data the host application already had in memory.
So what's the fix?
The proper design is a resource mapped to something like user.me profile. The host loads it automatically at the start of the session, and the model never wastes time asking.
It all comes down to respecting the boundaries of the system. So let's summarize the triad for everyone listening.
Go for it.
If you are building an AI server, tools are the model's hands they take action and cause side effects. Resources are the library they provide read-only context injected by the model or the host. And prompts are the user's steering wheel structured, reusable templates initiated by the human.
Adhering to those definitions prevents your server from becoming bloated and, frankly, prone to hallucinations.
Right.
But this architectural clarity actually surfaces a much deeper issue, which the text briefly teases for its chapter on security and OAuth token binding.
Ah, right. The security implications of giving autonomous models these kinds of capabilities.
Consider the reality of what we just mapped out. We are moving rapidly toward an ecosystem where autonomous agents bounce between thousands of interconnected servers.
It's a wild thought.
For anyone unfamiliar, OAuth is essentially a protocol that allows you to delegate authority, like giving a valet the key to drive your car, but not the key to open your trunk. It grants scoped access.
So we are binding these access tokens to AI models.
Exactly. We've established that the model is the entity autonomously deciding when to initiate tools, and those tools have real-world side effects.
Like spinning up web servers, sending emails to clients, purchasing inventory.
If an AI decides to execute a complex chain of tools across five different companies' servers on your behalf, how do we actually establish trust in that network?
Wow. When you combine the rigid precision of traditional software engineering with the murky, probabilistic decisions of a language model who is ultimately liable when the model decides to use its hands to break something.
That is the frontier we're looking at next.
You give the model hands, you eventually have to figure out who is accountable for the side effects. We will have to see how the Anthropic course untangles that nightmare in Chapter 4. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Take these primitives, build something elegant, and we will catch you next time.